excuse me, we're talking about gastrointestinal disease today for the next couple of hours. And although we're going to sort of cover the waterfront, the gastrointestinal system suffers from all the basic major causes of injury and disease, genetic problems or congenital problems, toxic injury, infectious injury, neoplasia, traumatic, all that kind of business. And we're going to talk a little bit about all kinds of injuries like that. I'm going to focus, there are going to be a couple things that come up that are sometimes could be a little confusing, and I want you to be kind of tuned up when we get there. We're going to talk about two different kinds of peptic or gastric, two different kinds of ulcers in the stomach, okay? And we'll be using the term stress in two different ways, one meaning psychological stress and the other real physiological stress, and I'll explain that when we get there. I'm going to spend a little time on inflammatory bowel disease. It's a very common problem. There are two basic categories, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And we're going to spend a little bit of time dealing with that. And obviously colon cancer. Malignancies of the GI tract, and especially colon cancer, are not uncommon. And that's something to really talk about. It's the one thing that we have definitely, pre-screening has made a big difference in terms of early detection and getting to people before the stuff is really metastatic, or it's at least in a manageable form. And so the death rate is like breast cancer. The incidence of breast cancer is pretty well stabilized, although it was rising for years, but for many years the death from breast cancer was falling. The same goes for colon cancer. And the reason was that with early detection and so forth, we were able to actually intervene before things were so far along there wasn't much to do. And so looking at colon cancer, and it's an interesting thing also in colon cancer, we see malignancies developing because there are really two mutations that have to occur in order for colon cancer to develop. And again, it's the kind of thing that has a different presentation based on where it is in the GI tract, where it is in the colon. Presentations on right-sided colon cancers and left-sided colon cancers are quite a bit different, even though the tumor is exactly the same. So we'll talk about that and why some of those seemingly lie dormant for a long time. Well, what I'm going to do, though, is this is sort of the routine that I go through, and we're going to look at congenital things, things that are developmental, and then we'll move, and we're going to kind of go geographically. We're going to start with the esophagus, and that's where we are now. Now, there are some developmental things that can happen with abnormalities of the GI tract, and there can be areas in which it simply doesn't form properly, and we might have a narrowed area, so-called stenosis, or a completely absent and blind-ending section known as an atresia. In this case, we're looking at what's called a fistula, which is a communication here with the esophagus and the trachea. The problem actually that presents itself with a newborn is it's pretty much the same with all of these, and that is that the kid cannot feed, cannot swallow, and so in utero it doesn't make a big difference. But when they're born, then they cough this stuff up. The saliva can't go down the GI tract, they can't feed, so they cough it goes down the trachea, and they end up with a pneumonia. So they aspirate when they're trying to feed or trying to swallow, and pneumonia is the leading cause of death when we don't correct these things quickly. Well, obviously, all malnutrition is going to be an issue as well if we should have something like this, a missing segment and a tretic portion of the esophagus right here, or a fistula such as you see right there. So these are things that are curable, are certainly surgically correctable, even when we have an absent portion, a fairly significant absent portion down here. It actually is fixable because we can go borrow a portion of bowel from someplace else and bring it up there and sort of sister it in there. The problem is that this is kind of a tricky surgery because this is in the chest, and you're working on a kid that's about the size of a house cat, and it's right behind the heart. And so trying to do that surgery is fairly complicated. This shows the kind of approach that's taken from that, and again, removing the lung and the heart out of the way here, and there's the blind-ending portion of the esophagus up here, and here it is that we're going to go ahead and re-anastomose those, or at least get those together like they're supposed to. So this is a congenital thing that does happen with some regularity. Another thing that we will see will be narrowing of the outlet of the stomach. The pyloric sphincter sometimes will have a extra muscle around it so that the pyloric sphincter doesn't actually relax. And in that case, the kid can eat, but not much goes on because it doesn't pass out of the stomach. And again, coughing and spitting up the formula and so forth is not an uncommon thing. So areas of narrowing and missing segments of the bowel are typically what we see with congenital abnormalities here. Now, acquired problems of the esophagus fit into a couple of categories, one of irritation and pain and reflux, which is very common. You know, we see these ads all the time on television. Go talk to your doctor about this kind of reflux medication or something like that, antacid. One of the complications that we will have when you have a lot of inflammation of the esophagus, and particularly the distal portion of the esophagus, is scarring down in here. And also, because of the inflammation that may involve the entire wall, we'll end up losing some of the ganglia cells. Now, remember that this, we don't swallow. When we swallow, food doesn't go into the stomach by gravity action. It's not going down there because gravity is pulling it there. If you're hanging from your heels and you're swallowing, it's going to end up in your stomach because there's peristaltic action that pushes it along, and smooth muscle that does that. And the coordination of that action is propagated by the Meissner's and Auerbach's plexus. The innervation comes in that way. And now, if you lose those ganglia cells, those neurons that are there in the muscle, if you will end up with basically a breakdown of the peristaltic action. And in this case, that might even mean lack of relaxation of the sphincter down here, the gastric sphincter. The normal default condition of that is that it's always constricted. And in order for you, so that things don't just sort of flow back up. And so it's always constricted. And so when you swallow, the last action is to dilate the sphincter. And that is done by the action of the ganglia cells, the nerve cells that are there. When we lose the ganglia cells, then that doesn't happen. And so everything starts to accumulate. The esophagus dilates. All this junk is in there. And it leads to, well, you can imagine, leads to infectious problems because the stuff is, obviously, the food is not sterile. Erosions of the mucosa and things of that kind. So the scarring and lack of ganglia cells, which occurs as a consequence of the inflammation. Yes, somebody could be born, Zunheit, missing some of these ganglia cells, but by the time a person's 45 and all of a sudden these symptoms appear, you'd say, well, it isn't something you were born with. This is something that's acquired or occurred over time. And typically it's because of the inflammation that occurs here because of reflux, basically because many of us, certainly me included, I've been working on my paunch for a while here. We have a lot of abdominal fat, reflux and so forth goes on, and that leads to the inflammation down here. When I say reflux, I'm talking about gastric acid and stuff coming back up through that sphincter. Even though it's closed, it isn't always real effective if we have a lot of abdominal pressure here. So that's one of the problems. We call that achalasia. And achalasia is the inability of the sphincter to actually relax and let the let food and so forth come down through there. So everything sort of accumulates in here. And of course, you got real bad buffalo breath because all that's festering in there, gurgling away and rotting. And then, of course, you bring it back up. Well, at any rate, achalasia. This would be an acquired situation due to some scarring down there at the base of the distal end of the esophagus, lack of the ganglia cells as a consequence of the inflammation and injury that went on, say, over years. Sometimes we'll see scarring and rings that if we get a barium study where you swallow something that is radio opaque, x-ray opaque, we can actually see these rings and scarring and so forth, such as you see right here. And that's typically indicative of, again, reflux and eventually some injury to the epithelium, chronic inflammation of the esophagus and scarring. Now, occasionally people will have diverticuliform. Diverticula are little out pouches that occur, and they are a little blind ending pouch. This is not a tumor that's growing, a solid tumor, it's actually hollow. And the mouth of it communicates here with the esophagus, the lumen of the esophagus. So junk can get caught over here. These things occur for a couple of reasons. One's called traction, the other pulsion. In other words, there's something, if you have a lot of pressure within the esophagus, it may be a congenitally weak area, maybe an area that didn't have quite as much smooth muscle as it should, and as you try to swallow, it kind of pooches itself out. Another would be if you had a lot of scarring down in this area, it may act as the scar contracts, it'll pull on the wall and create a little pouch here, a little blind-ending pouch. the ones that occur up here in the neck and up in this area, Zinker's diverticulum, have kind of an interesting history that goes with them. I don't know if we'd have anybody in here from Wisconsin, but there was a famous person from Appleton, Wisconsin, by the name of Harry Weiss. Anybody know who would? Harry Weiss was a great magician back in the early 1900s. Very famous guy. His stage name was Harry Houdini. And Harry Weiss, had a Zinker's diverticulum. And so the story goes, he could swallow, and he knew kind of where it was. He could swallow, say, a key or a pick for a lock, sort of tip his neck so it would come over there. And then one of his famous tricks would be to be stripped buck naked and locked into something, and before long he appeared. And what he would do is, someone who had heard him getting out of a jail cell that way, heard him coughing and retching, and he was bringing up a pick or something that he used to pick the lock, and basically knew how to use that. So amazingly enough, they do come in handy. The problem with them really is that you don't want one. I'll tell you, we surgically cut these things out and seal it up. But also, food gets trapped over there. And again, if you've got, you know, half of last night's dinner or a couple of good-sized bites of last night's dinner festering over there, I can guarantee you by morning you have breath. No one wants to stand very close to you. But at any rate, these are diverticular. We'll talk about colonic diverticulae a little bit later. Okay, here's a problem which is, again, becoming more common, partly because of our size, the pressure in the abdomen. And these are the hiatal hernia. There are actually two forms of hiatal hernia. When we talk about that, what we're talking about is that a portion of the stomach has been dislocated up into the chest. It's as if the esophagus is too short. These two bands of muscle you see right here, this is the diaphragm, and this is the opening where the esophagus should come through. And in the normal condition, the esophagus, the cardiac sphincter right here, is basically right there at that level. Well, you can see there's gastric part of the stomach is up there. And so in large part, that is kind of due to, again, abdominal pressure from abdominal fat and so forth. And the problem is that there's sort of a constriction or narrowing here, and then you end up with a retention of acid, fluid, food, and so forth in here. And the pressure that might build up in that portion of the hiatal hernia, that's what it refers to, comes through this hiatus right here. It causes reflux back up into the esophagus. Well, this sphincter right there will not be sufficiently strong to keep acid and so forth from coming. You can see in this depiction that there are already ulcerations of the mucosa. Here you can see up in here. So there's regurgitation of food and acid and that sort of business. This is known as a sliding type. And it's just as if part of the stomach has slid up through here. Well, it's been sort of pressured up through there. This actually is a very tricky thing to correct, and the surgical correction doesn't work terribly well unless other changes occur in the person. That is to say, if you still have a lot of abdominal fat, a lot of intra-abdominal pressure, we can go ahead, you say, why don't we just go in there and surgically grab that sucker and pull it down and sew it into place, and that's what they do, effectively. But often it will go ahead and reoccur unless there's something done about the amount of weight that the person's carrying and the amount of abdominal fat. So this is known as a sliding type hiatal hernia. There's another variation of this which can really lead to serious problems, and this is known as a rolling type. And what you'll see here is there is still, here in this case, diaphragms. This is where the cardiac sphincter is, so-called cardiac sphincter of the esophagus. But you'll see that part of it has pooched out like a little diverticulum up there. And what's being depicted in that is something that does happen with this type, and that is because of the compression, the narrowed and compressed area right here, there's really reduced blood flow into that part of the stomach, into that diverticulum. And it's enough to sort of keep it almost alive, and you'll see that the mucosa begins to break down. It's not enough to really make it vital. And so if parts of it do die, then there's enough blood trickling through there that there's often bleeding and things like that, can lead to a perforation and so on. So this known as a rolling type can be a very serious form of ulceration up in it and bleeding from the mucosa. This is kind of an outrageous example where the whole stomach is dislocated up there. We did look at an example of something like this when we were doing the respiratory unit. You remember we talked about the diaphragmatic hernias. We had a diaphragmatic hernia and the GI tract developmentally in a fetus, part of it is dislocated into the thorax. You remember that? Compresses the lung. Lung doesn't develop. Kid needs two lungs when they're born. If they don't, they're going to die. In that situation, that you can act, that can be corrected in utero, surprisingly, with intrauterine surgery. Esophagitis, I've mentioned that a couple of times now. We have inflammation of the esophagus as a consequence of the reflux of the acid. Now, you can have inflammation on the basis of a whole variety of things. Yes, we can have a bacterial esophagitis. It's not very common. I mean, we've got bacteria there all the time. And one of the reasons that we don't have a proliferation of pathological forms of bacteria and causing a real bacterial infection in our esophagus is the same reason we don't hear in the mouth, and you don't say the female vagina doesn't have, well, as if there were a male vagina, but at any rate, but is you have normal flora, and the normal flora that live there create an environment that is not really conducive to other kinds of bacteria growing. And sometimes when we see problems with bacteria, and particularly overgrowth, in the case of esophagus, it's because someone's been treated with a broad-spectrum antibiotic, and we've killed off their normal flora. Bacterial infections do occur, but they're kind of unusual. Virus is much more common. We can have viral infections in here, particularly related to HIV disease. And I don't mean to say that HIV is infecting these epithelial cells, but simply because you don't control the normal kind of exposure that we all have to certain viruses, and especially to fungi there, that then they can get a toehold. Toxic agents, particularly chemotherapeutic agents, and occasionally autoimmune injury. This is showing the epithelium of the esophagus. The muscle is all the way down here. Doesn't show in this picture. Here's the lumen up here. And this is the, you will see there are a number of kind of dead cells up through here. We'll see inflammatory cells scattered throughout. And this is evidence of esophagitis. Most of the esophagitis is toxic. And the toxin that does it is our acid, is our stomach acid, what we're normally producing. And if it refluxes back up in there, this guy is really not equipped to handle that. The stomach has its own method of protecting itself from the acid that it produces, which is largely creating a mucus barrier, such that the stomach mucosa is then isolated, or it's covered over with this mucus barrier that protects us from its own acid. The esophagus doesn't have anything like that. And so if we have acid reflux back up into the esophagus, that's kind of a chemical burn, and that's really what produces most of it. But there are other agents, keep that in mind, especially in people who are immune suppressed, whether it's chemotherapy or whether it's HIV disease, and there we will see increased number of viral infections and particularly fungal infections that involve that. We're always exposed to these fungi. We're always exposed to the spores and the fungi, and they don't get a toehold in any of us, even though they're right there, because our T cells get in there and take care of them before they have a chance to do anything. Somebody with HIV doesn't have that. Here's an example of some of the changes that the esophagus may undergo if it's exposed to it, referred to a Barrett's change or Barrett's esophagus. And this is an important thing when someone looks down in there with a scope. And right now, this picture is the cardiac sphincter area looking right down to the stomach. So this has gone all the way down the esophagus and it's looking at the distal portion of it. And normally the mucosa is kind of silvery or pink. It actually looks just like the mucosa of your mouth. It's very slippery. In the photograph, it looks kind of white here. And this bright red stuff we see here is actually a metaplastic change in which the mucosa of the esophagus has been exposed to acid reflux, and it has undergone a modification. And actually what it starts to look like is your colon. What it looks like is columnar epithelium and lots of mucin-secreting cells that are there. And so it's trying to protect itself. And what that tells us is that there's been a lot of injury in order to go to that point to have this metaplasia occur. Now, we've talked about that in another situation. We talked about metaplasia somewhere else, particularly in the lungs. You remember that business? Remember, a leading cause of lung cancer is squamous cell. It was a squamous cell carcinoma. You might say there's no squamous cells lining the lung, lining the bronchi. And that metaplasia occurred because of injury, chronic stress of cigarette smoke. Here we're looking at the chronic stress of acid reflux, and it's switching over to a mucosal surface that is better adept at handling that. Well, the problem is it's telling us this in and of itself is not necessarily a cancer risk, but it's saying that there is this ongoing injury, ongoing stress, and I'm doing the best I can to hold up against it. This is what I'm doing. I've converted to a different epithelial type that's better at surviving in the presence of that acid. But if it continues and continues, it beats up this epithelium, then it's inflamed, and eventually, and not eventually, but in some people, we can see a malignancy evolve, malignancy develop. So we really have two possibilities for cancers of the esophagus. One would be malignancies that come from the regular squamous epithelium that lines it, and the other might be a malignancy that comes from this metaplastic columnar epithelium that looks like colon. And indeed, in years past, when we would see most squamous cell most carcinomas of the esophagus were squamous cell, and they're related to either cigarette smoking or eating a lot of smoked meats. And squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus was not an uncommon thing in the early 1900s because of the way meats were preserved, and particularly using nitrates and things like that. Today, it's roughly 50-50 squamous cell, thanks to cigarette smoking, believe it or not, and adenocarcinomas arising from the cancer, arising from this Barrett's change, which was the best effort the esophagus could do to protect itself from the acid reflux. But the acid reflux went on. This is what it looks like. This is what the Barrett's change looked like. And to show this to anybody who looks at a lot of biopsies would immediately say, that's colon. That's not esophagus. It's got deep glands just the way the colon does. It's got lots of mucin-secreting cells. And in no way it looks like squamous epithelium. But that is the transformation that occurs. And if the injury goes on, then some of those cells might become malignant. We can have vascular abnormalities involving the esophagus, and here we're looking at varicosities related to this right over here, and I talk about on the recording. This is a cirrhosis of the liver, and the issue with these dilated vessels when we have a cirrhotic liver is that the scarring in the liver reduces the number of channels the blood can flow when it comes back from the GI tract. Remember, the flow of blood here from the GI tract is through the portal vein, and all of that blood comes back through most of that blood comes back through the liver. So the liver can act on it. It can detoxify the stuff that's in our food. It will deal with nutrients and so forth. If you have a lot of scarring in there, you reduce the number of channels the blood's going to try and find it back somehow. I mean, it can't get through the liver. How's it going to get back to the heart? How's it going to get back into the systemic circulation? It's kind of like I use the analogy of, I've used this before, and we talked about hemodynamic disorders. If you're coming back from the mall, and you're on 3rd Street up here, and you being the good citizen that you are, you're going to be in that left-hand lane because you know that up there at the fire station, everybody has to get together, right? But you got this turkey that's in that inside lane, right? And they're racing you, and you're thinking, am I going to let them in? Hell no, I'm not. They can end up in that front yard where you see a lot of cars, right? Well, sometimes they just come in there anyway, so that's actually that's a spot where we see a lot of collisions like that. You know the place I'm talking about, yes? Yeah, you all know that. Well, you're behind that. Suppose you're 10 cars behind that. What are you going to do? You're going to sit there and wait for them to clear away the trash? Man, I'm not. You're going to start taking the side streets, right? To get around the accident site, and that's what's happened here. This is where the accident is. It's in here. It's the scarring in the liver due to chronic injury, cirrhosis, and so the blood's going to find some alternate pathway to get back into the systemic circulation. And what you're going to end up with will be these dilated vessels here around the umbilicus and in the hemorrhoidal veins. And when these right here, if these start bleeding, Katie, bar the door, that's the end. Very thin-walled, high-pressure venous, which is not designed to deal with high pressure at all. In fact, the leading cause of death of people with cirrhosis is bleeding esophageal varices. And that is a consequence of the blood trying to find an alternate pathway back to the systemic circulation, back to the systemic venous return. This just shows a picture of a varices. Now, this is an autopsy picture over here, and it's hard to tell it what's going on. Here's the stomach. Here's the esophagus. Here's a great big old dilated a vein. Here was one, but of course there's no blood in them now, so it's hard to tell that. Here you can see a split in it, and this is the picture of that one, and it shows this great big dilated vein right here, and there's the blowout point, and that person died for that reason. So esophageal varices, very serious complication, and I'm not entirely sure what that picture shows. Okay, carcinoma, that was some kind of x-ray picture that I can't interpret. I'm a pathologist, not a radiologist, so I don't know why I should take one out of there. Carcinoma of the esophagus, I've already mentioned, comes in a couple of stripes. In years past, it was really related to nitrates in the food and smoked meats and whatnot. But today, it's in large part due to repeat irritation due to esophageal reflux and so forth. Tobacco plays a very important role, tobacco use, in terms of squamous cell carcinomas. There's just a little tag of stomach right here. This is a surgical specimen. This is not an autopsy specimen, although I would imagine the person is deceased now. So you have a little bit of stomach right here. This is the cardiac sphincter, and here you can see this big cancer in there. So normally, the expected kind of malignancy would be squamous cell, because that's what lines the esophagus, and that's what all this kind of glistening mucosa is here. This one right here is probably a Barrett's occurring in something like that, and that would be adeno or glandular carcinoma. And the two are roughly equal now. This is showing a squamous cell carcinoma, and it's invasive. Here's the squamous epithelium that lines the esophagus, and here, right here, you can see the point of the cancer, and you can see it invading into the wall. Okay, we're going to move off into the stomach now. And here an important thing is gastritis. Gastritis means just inflammation. And we do a lot of things. So a lot of stomach inflammation. Inflammation of the mucosa and subsequently of the wall. I would say one of the most important ones is taking a lot of aspirin, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Aspirin and that sort of thing that irritate the stomach. We'll explain how that works. Alcohol can cause a raging gastritis. I'd wager everybody in here has had a viral gastritis at some point in their lives. You know, when you're a kid, you're kind of getting used to the world and the viruses that are out there, and it's an infection of the gastric epithelial cells, and you feel like hell. You have cramping in your barf for about 2 or 3 days. You get dehydrated. You look like hell, you know. Somebody takes you to the emergency room and waters you back up. Maybe they don't need to do that. Everybody had the barfs in here? Is anybody who's not had a gastritis as a kid? You know what I'm talking about here? I need some life here. Come on. Okay. Well, gastritis from that, from viral infections and so forth. An important one that we will look at here with respect to long-term complications is Helicobacter pylori. Helicobacter pylori is, believe it or not, a normal constituent of our gastric mucosa, of the bacteria that we have in our GI tract, in our stomach. And in fact, it is probably that they play some role, and I'm not quite sure how, in actually protecting us from some of the esophageal problems that we were just talking about. So why am I listing that here under H. pylori as a cause of gastritis when I'm telling you that it's normally part of our gastric normal flora? Well, obviously not all H. pylori are cut from the same cloth. In fact, the pathological H. pylori has an plasmid in it. It's acquired a plasmid that codes for a couple of enzymes, and that's what changes it. You know, there are a lot of cholera organisms out there. We'll say a few words about cholera when we get to the colon, but a lot of cholera organisms out there. Cholera lives in the water. It's got a flagellum that lets it swim. And in fact, most times we see cholera infections, it's in the skin in people who were out wading. So why is it that somebody basically squirts themselves to death? They die of cholera infection because they become so dehydrated. It's pathological strains. The GI pathological strains have acquired a plasmid that codes for a particular toxin. In this case, H. pylori, it's not a good idea, we have found, to try and sterilize ourselves of H. pylori because there's a good guy. There is H. pylori that wears the white hat. And there's also the H. pylori that's gone over to the dark side. And that H. pylori has acquired a plasmid that codes for several enzymes we'll talk about. Well, in that particular case, that H. pylori does very definitely lead to gastritis, ulcers, and the chronic infection of it can actually lead to a gastric cancer. When we see acute inflammation of the stomach, typically lots of polys are there, unless it's really related to a viral infection. You can have a lot of sloughing of the mucosa and bleeding and that sort of thing. And because of the irritation, you have a lot of cramping and you throw up a lot. Now, a chronic gastritis is a different beast. Chronic gastritis is something that we typically see related to one of a couple of things. Either a chronic infection with the pathological strain of H. pylori, or we see it in older people where they have developed an autoimmune condition in which they, their immune system by antibody and by T cells have decided that their gastric mucosa is actually an enemy and we should attack it. Most chronic gastritis fits into that category there. We see that in older people. That fits, I guess that would be me, and people above my age. And so most of the times, then the inflammatory infiltrate is somewhat different. It will be obviously lymphocytes and things like that. Remember, there are three features of chronic inflammation. It doesn't matter whether it occurs in the GI tract, the lungs, the liver, or whatever it is. There are three important features of what we call, characterized as chronic inflammation. One is that they have that distinctive inflammatory cell, natolymphocytes and macrophages. Number two, it goes on, it's chronic, it's got duration. And number three, an important feature is fibrosis. There's lots and lots of scarring. And the scarring comes about because of the release of cytokines from the macrophages. And what we're looking at here is scarring here in the lamina propria, and basically atrophy of the mucosa. Of course, the mucosa is really under attack here by the antibodies and so forth. So acute and chronic gastritis are two different beasts. In some situations, H. pylori is a common factor. H. pylori may play a role in sort of changing some, at least the pathological form of it. May do something about changing our host resistance or immune tolerance in terms of what the mucosa is going to look like. That aspect is still to be worked out. When the guy came along and looked at this H. pylori and said, you know something, I think that this is related to causing ulcers and gastric inflammation and stuff like that, he was literally laughed off the stage because everybody knew we had H. pylori in our stomachs. What difference would it make? And he said, I'm telling you, there's a variety of this that's different and it does play a role. Eventually, I actually got the Nobel Prize for that. But at any rate, that's the beast. That's a different kind of beast in a way because it carries a plasmid that confers the pathogenicity of that particular strain of H. pylori. All right, I want you to know the difference between chronic and acute gastritis. Look here, some of the long-term effects of chronic gastritis. Well, we have mucosal atrophy, so that's going to change your ability to really digest food. We have a lot of lymphocytes. We have a lot of proliferation of cells that might become malignant. And importantly, people who have it will become vitamin B12 deficient. Now, we don't absorb, we haven't talked about that yet, but we don't absorb B12 in the stomach. Does anybody know how we absorb B12? It's a rather complex process. We did talk about it with respect to anemias. Yeah, intrinsic factor. The stomach produces the intrinsic factor that binds the B12, otherwise the bacteria in the GI tract will suck it up, they'll get it. And the only way we can get it and protect it from the bacteria is to bind it, and then it goes all the way downstream, we actually absorb in the distal ileum. But in this particular case, if you've killed the cells that produce it, produce the intrinsic factor, you can't bind it, and so you can't absorb it. So people will become B12 deficient. So the symptoms are different. In fact, sometimes the chronic gastritis symptoms are very subtle and we don't know about it until they present with some long-term complication indicating it's been going on for a long time. This is an example of chronic gastritis, kind of an atrophic or withered mucosa, lots and lots of lymphocytes all spread around there. Well, let's go ahead and take a look here at the role of H. pylori and the fact that it's going to play a role in terms of ulcer disease and chronic gastritis and even the development of gastric cancers in some people. It is a gram-negative rod. It lives kind of here in this kind of zone right here in the mucosa. So we're looking here at a gastric gland here, the epithelial cells. These are lymphocytes down here. And here we can see the stain, a special stain for them. And again, the ones that have that the plasmid in it, the plasmid codes for a couple of enzymes, one of which is a urease, that it secretes into the environment, and what it's doing is it's breaking down the mucosa. Breaking down the mucus, the snot on the surface of this. That's how we protect ourselves from our own gastric acid. We produce snot that's out there. And this thing can break that down. It also has now developed an ability to actually migrate into the wall. Normally, it just stays right out there in the GI tract, but given that, it can now migrate into the wall. So these are some of the things that change when we take a look at losing the protective barrier between the acid now. That means we can set up the process of starting a peptic ulcer, getting some kind of digestive process going on the mucosa itself. It apparently also, once we get down in here, it invades the wall. It can then either change some of the antigens, or they're in common with our own GI tract, such that we have then some sort of immunogenic kind of process where we might see antibodies later in the form of leading to chronic gastritis. An interesting thing does happen when we see colonization of the duodenum with this, and that is with H. pylori, and that is a duodenal mucosa also undergoes metaplasia and becomes like gastric. And here you're busy producing acid in an area of the GI tract where you don't want to produce acid at all. The acid production should only be in the stomach. And when the food and so forth comes out, by the way, pH about 1, that's what it is. And when it comes through the pyloric sphincter, we have all kinds of glands there that secrete bicarbonate. And they secrete the bicarbonate right into the stuff as it comes through. So it neutralizes the acid and brings it back up to, 5 or 6, maybe up to 7 or so pH. If you have replaced that mucosa with gastric mucosa, you're making acid where you're trying to neutralize the acid. Obviously, it backfires. All right, I'm going to talk about two different kinds of ulcers. One we often call a peptic ulcer. That's my preferred term, sometimes called a chronic ulcer. This is the ulcer that is related to H. pylori. It's related to taking a lot of aspirin. It is a issue of the ability of the barrier to gastric mucosa to protect itself from the acid that it secretes, or it's the problem of being able to regenerate the mucosa that we all lose every single day. Now, the snot on the surface of this does a pretty good job of protecting us from our own stomach acid, but it's not 100%. And as a consequence, we are constantly, every day, renewing our mucosa. It takes about 5 days, by the way, to completely and totally replace your gastric mucosa. Actually, 5 days, you replace everything from your lips down to the other end. But so there's always some leakage of acid back there, even under the best of circumstances. Okay, so you can have an ulcer form, so there's always repair. My point is, under the normal circumstances, you're sitting out there right now, there's some acid that's being leaked behind the snot covering, and it's doing damage to the mucosa, but you're rebuilding your mucosa, so it doesn't cause an ulcer. So you can cause an ulcer, you can have an ulcer, an actual digestive hole develop for one of two reasons. Either you can change the amount of mucus, reduce that, or increase the amount of acid that's there, or you can change your capacity to repair the normal little bit of injury that occurs every single day. So you got one of two possibilities. What's occurring with H. pylori is that you're changing the barrier out here so that the acid can get through more easily, and so you have a lot more repair to do and you can't really keep up with it. What the aspirin is doing is it's changing your ability to repair. So people who take a lot of aspirin really have normal acidity in the stomach. They've got a normal snot covering over it. It's just that what little bit of injury occurs every day they can't fix. And so that's why that leads to ulcers there. So one of two reasons. Either too much acid, and you could actually have way more acid than you ever should have. What's the stimulus to produce acid? Where does that come from? The stomach just decide on its own, I'm going to make a lot of acid today? There's a hormonal stimulus. There are several things that go on. Of course, it comes from here. If you eat something, you want to make acid. And so it's got a through the cranial nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus, stimulates the production of it. But there's also a hormonal stimulation that comes from islet cells in the pancreas. You know where I'm going? I know we haven't done the endocrine unit yet, but gastrin. Gastrin is produced by some of the islet cells that stimulates the stomach to release acid. And if you have too much gastrin, you make too much acid. And in that case, it doesn't matter how much snot you got on the surface or how effective you are at repairing the little bits of damage that occur every day, you can't keep up with it. It's just buckets of acid. All right, so we got three possibilities now, I guess. One, you got buckets of acid because you got some screwy tumor in the pancreas. All right, that happens, but it's not very common. Number two, you can mess with the snot covering on the surface of this thing so that the acid gets through to it. Or number three, you can diminish the capacity of the stomach to repair itself from everyday little bits of injury. And that's what will lead to, basically, it looks like an impact crater. All right, you digest that. Now, normally the pepsin and all that stuff and the acid that's out there, the job of that, of course, is to digest the Budweiser and cheeseburgers, right? Which it does. Unfortunately, it also digesting you. And you'll see that it can burrow right through the stomach and, in fact, straight on through. And then everything leaks out in the abdominal cavity. And then you end up with abdominal with pH out there, low pH, and bacteria and gastric juices in your abdominal cavity. It's like having a third-degree burn over about 80% of your body. And the news is you're going to die. It's that simple. So a hole in the stomach is a really, really bad thing, particularly if it completely penetrates through the wall. This is a peptic ulcer. It digests itself. It's the action of pepsin. It's the action of the digestive process. Unfortunately, it's on you as opposed to cheeseburgers and Budweiser. Alrighty. This is the Zoller-Ellison ZE syndrome. Here you want to know about that. That's the idea of having too much gastrin because you have a little tumor in the pancreas. You know, I mean, one of the important things you need to know right now, you probably already know it, probably already come about it, but when we take a look at things like this that seemingly occur 1 in 100,000 or 10,000 or something like that, as opposed to something like this up here, which occurs in 1 in 20, what are we going to ask you about on the test? We're going to ask you about the thing that doesn't occur very often, right? And as something becomes vanishingly rare, the importance on the test becomes so high, so great, that you can count it's about 30% of the test, right? Kind of bronze inverse relationship of what I think you need to know and what we ask you about. But I do want you to know about Zollinger-Ellison syndrome because it reflects the physiology, the abnormal physiology, the extension of the making the stomach acid. It looks like I went backwards, and maybe I did. But at any rate, H. pylori plays an important role in the formation of those stomach ulcers because it destroys that covering. And we can test for that in a variety of ways, and we can look to see if that person's H. pylori is indeed the Darth Vader kind of thing, and then we're going to treat it. But we want to be careful not to just go ahead and treat away all H. pylori. This is showing what we have with the good and the evil here. That you've got two possibilities to form an ulcer. Under the normal circumstances, there's always regeneration going on every single day. There's always kind of an attack, but you got the snot covering right here. You can either diminish this or you can diminish that, and that's what's going to lead to the ulcer. So that's how aspirin works in one way. H. pylori and things that have increased acid work the other way. Now, does stress play a role in this kind of ulcer, this peptic ulcer? It probably does to a very minimal degree, and by that I mean psychological stress. Under psychological stress, there's increased acid production. There actually is. Yes, there is. We know that. Is it enough to cause an ulcer? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it contributes to it. But in a person who, is smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day and drinking 30 cups of coffee a day and everything else, they're probably, it probably plays a role. But it's psychological stress. You see, there's a difference between real psychological stress, but surprise. Let's suppose at this moment that SP strolls in here with the exam and says, you know what, instead of next Friday, I'm going to give it to you now. And you might say, God, we were all shocked by that. No, you weren't shocked. You were surprised, maybe. You know, you were greatly stressed by it, but it's psychological stress. That's a different kind of stress than what we call physiological stress. Physiological stress is dying sick. I'm going to die in the next 20 minutes if you don't do something. Physiological stress leads to what we call stress ulcers. I wish we had never used that term because the ulcer to me is like what we were just looking at where it drills a hole deep into the wall. These I would prefer in your textbook now uses the term stress erosions, which is what we should have been calling them all along, but lots of places still call it stress ulcers. Stress ulcers occur for totally different reasons. Now, I'll grant you got to have a little bit of acid around or you're not going to really have the mucosa go, but this does not occur because of a problem of increased acidity. It doesn't occur because of taking aspirin or something like that. When I say physiologic stress, someone's really stressed. It means they've been, say, like involved in a bad car accident. They got 15 broken bones. 30% of their blood supply is now out on the street someplace, and they are absolutely, they're in shock. Their blood pressure is 80 over nothing, and they're going to die in the next 10 minutes if we don't do something about it. Stress is when they have an overwhelming infection. There are gram-negative rods proliferating in the back, in the bloodstream. They've got gram-negative sepsis. They're going to die now if we don't do something, and they probably will die anyway. This is physiologic stress of a galactic proportion. This is nothing at all like psychological stress, all right? Physiological stress, remember there were with the, when you have something like this, they talk about the four F's of kind of survival, you know, flight, fright, that sort of business, about vascular constriction. The epinephrine release is phenomenal. You have a lot of vascular constriction in places where you say, well, I'm going to route the blood away from the stomach because I'm going to get it to the kidneys, the heart, and the and my brain. Because if I survive this sucker, I can maybe redo this, but I can't grow a new brain. All right, I'm not going to be able to reproduce my kidney. And so there are certain areas that during times of extraordinary stress, whether because of, say, hypovolemia, blood loss, vascular dilatation, and so forth, there are some places that we say we're going to sacrifice and just hope things come back. And the GI tract is one of them. The vessels of the GI tract clamp down so hard that what will happen is we'll have little bits of the mucosa literally die and fall off. These things right here are a vascular phenomenon. You see, these right here are where we have kind of overlapping blood supply, and in between those two arterioles that come up, there's a little area in the middle that requires blood from both to stay alive. And if both of those arterioles are really clamped off, that section in between the two, the watershed area, is going to die. And that's what we're looking at. These are the things that come up in people who have this extraordinary physiological stressful situation, and it's the last thing we need. They can actually lose a lot of blood. What I'd like you to see here is that it is just the mucosa. There's no penetration into the wall. Okay, we're looking at a section of one of these things. It doesn't go into the wall. It doesn't perforate. We do try to control the acid in these people, even though it probably doesn't mean much, probably because it makes us feel better like we're doing something. But also, we just want to optimize the chances that the mucosa will stick together. But it's dying because of a vascular problem, because of vascular constriction. Okay, we're going to take our break now. We'll come back and we'll talk about gastric cancers. And I'll see you in 10. Okay?